Good morning. Please turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 29. Genesis 29. One of my goals in doing this series on modern day idolatry is to explore all the different ways that we can take good things and turn them into false gods. All the different ways we can take what is good and make it into an idol. In Romans chapter 1, the Apostle Paul gives us a handy little definition of idolatry. He says in verse 25 that they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served created things rather than the Creator who is forever praised. What is idolatry? Basically, idolatry is worshiping and serving a created thing rather than the Creator. Idolatry is looking to something in creation rather than the Creator for our sense of purpose, meaning, value, and significance. One of the ways of explaining how idolatry happens, and it happens all the time, one of the ways it happens to explain it is to first recognize that we all have a hole in our heart. We all have this hole. We wake up every morning with this sense, sometimes it's vague, but an echo, but we have the sense that something is still missing. Our lives are incomplete. We have this ache for more, that who we are and what we're doing is not enough. There must be something more. We all have this hole in our heart. Some call it original sin. Some call it our childhood wound. Some call it human nature. Doesn't really matter to me what we call it as long as we can acknowledge it, because it's there. It's always there, and it is the source of so much unhappiness, so much frustration, so much dissatisfaction in our lives. Idolatry then happens when we try to fill the hole in our heart, the gap in our lives, with any other created thing. The reason the heart is an idol factory is that we are constantly looking for something else that can fill the hole in our heart. We try money, we try power, we try fame or success, we try food, drugs, alcohol, we try sports, shopping, entertainment, and nothing works. Maybe it works temporarily, but nothing can bring lasting satisfaction. Nothing permanently fills the hole in our heart, and so we continue to look. Nothing, not even love, at least not romantic love. In the early 1970s, anthropologist Ernest Becker wrote the classic book, The Denial of Death. And what he does in The Denial of Death as an anthropologist is he observes how humanity, secular humans, by that I mean humanity who no longer really believes in or trusts God, turns to God for a sense of meaning and significance in life. Secular humanity, people who give up on the idea of God, he tracks how secular human beings still try to make sense of their lives after they've given up on the idea of God. And he says one of the ways that secular human beings still try to find purpose and meaning in life is by turning to what he calls apocalyptic romance. Does that not sound exciting? Apocalyptic romance, which can include apocalyptic sex and apocalyptic marriage and apocalyptic love. It's all very exciting. It's all very grand. It's this vision of something so good, so rich, so powerful that it gives us a sense of transcendence. And we turn to this idea of apocalyptic romance for a sense of purpose and meaning in life. This is how he describes it. He says, the love partner becomes the divine ideal within which to fulfill one's life. All spiritual and moral needs now become focused in one individual, the one you love, the one you desire, the one you promised the rest of your life to. Today's teaching, then, is about how we try to replace God with sex or romantic love or even marriage. Now, all of those are good things. All of those are good things created by God. And yet, when we turn to a good created thing in search of what only God can give, it always disappoints. And the result is disillusionment, heartache, heartbreak, chaos. There's an insightful example of this dynamic in Genesis chapter 29. Genesis 29, it's the part of the story where we read about Jacob. Jacob is Abraham's grandson, and by all accounts, Jacob is not a good guy. If you read through this story and you expect at some point Jacob is going to do something that makes you like him, you're going to be disappointed. He's really not a likable character. And in Genesis 29, he has already brought chaos into his life by deceiving his elderly father to give him Esau, his older brother's, blessing. And now Jacob is in Esau's crosshairs, which is not a good place to be because Esau is an accomplished hunter. So Jacob has to run away from home. He runs away to spend some time with his uncle Laban. And as Jacob runs away from home, running toward Laban, he's living anything but a hashtag blessed life. He's made a mess of his life. God has promised Abraham and Isaac and promised Jacob, I will bless you. And Jacob desperately is grasping for a blessing, and yet he's not yet blessed. His life is a mess. But upon arrival in his uncle Laban's camp, he quickly finds something with which he can fill the void, something that will give his life meaning and purpose, a blessing. Jacob falls in love. Let's pick up the story in chapter 29, verse 14. It said, after Jacob had stayed with him for a while, a whole month, Laban said to him, just because you are a relative of mine, should you work for me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be. Now, Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel had a lovely figure and was beautiful. And Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, I'll work for you for 7 years in return for your daughter Rachel. Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than some other man. Stay here with me. That's not exactly a vote of confidence from Laban. I'm like, yeah, I suppose you're the best we can do. So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seem like only a few days to him because of his love for her. Have you ever heard of limerence? Limerence is a fancy-sounding term coined by a psychologist named Dorothy Tenov, and this is how she explains limerence. She says it's an involuntary interpersonal state that involves an acute longing for emotional reciprocation, obsessive compulsive thoughts, feelings, and behavior, and emotional dependence on another person. That's limerence. Limerence is a chemical reaction that takes place in the brain that produces a high that is similar to narcotics. Limerence is what can make falling in love feel like being on drugs. If you've ever known someone who is otherwise reliable, rational, reasonable, to suddenly do irrational, unreasonable, unpredictable things when they fall in love, it's because of limerence, this chemical reaction firing off in the brain. Another name for limerence is being lovesick. And whatever you want to call it, Jacob has it. And his uncle Laban is shrewd, and he takes advantage of Jacob's obsession with his younger daughter, Rachel. He gets Jacob to offer to work 7 years for Rachel so she can become his bride. That is an exorbitant price to pay in that world for a bride. Well, let me pause here and just say this. We are not today going to judge this story according to our modern standards. This story is set in a world 3,000 years in the past, at least that long. This is an ancient story set in an ancient time, in an ancient world, where working 7 years for a bride is an exorbitant price. It's outrageous. But Jacob doesn't seem to mind, because he's in love, and he's got it bad. And so he works 7 years, and then after 7 years of labor for Rachel, he goes to Laban and tells him what he wants. Verse 21, Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife. My time is completed, and I want to make love to her." Now, the English translation actually takes a bit of the edge off of what Jacob said in the original language. Young men, this is not how one speaks to his future father-in-law about his daughter. But don't feel too bad for Laban, because once again, he's going to take advantage of Jacob's limerence, his love sickness, his obsession. We keep reading. It says, "So Laban brought together all the people of the place and gave a feast. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob, and Jacob made love to her," not Rachel. "And when morning came, there was Leah. So Jacob said to Laban, 'What is this you have done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me?' And Laban said, 'It's not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. Finish this daughter's bridal week, then we will give you the younger one also in return for another 7 years of work.'" And Jacob did so. He finished the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife, and Jacob made love to Rachel also, and his love for Rachel was greater than his love for Leah, and he worked for Laban another 7 years. Don't feel sorry for Laban. He's got a bad son-in-law. But also don't feel sorry for Jacob. If you want to feel sorry for someone in this story, feel sorry for Leah. She's the older daughter, and she has weak eyes. And we don't really know what that means, but loosely translated, I think it means she ain't worth 7 years of hard work. She lives in the shadow of Rachel, also known as Becky with the good hair. Her beautiful little sister with the perfect figure. And she knows she'll never be as beautiful. She'll never be as wanted as her little sister. But she also sees a way for her to capture her husband's heart. She can give him something that every man in the ancient world longs for, something every man in the ancient world needs to secure his legacy. She can give him a son, and that is exactly what she does. In verse 31, it says, "When the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, he enabled her to conceive, but Rachel remained childless. Leah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Reuben, for she said, 'It is because the Lord has seen my misery.'" And then look at this next line. "Surely my husband will love me now." What does Leah want more than anything else in the world? She wants her husband to love her. She wants to be loved by her husband, which probably means she wants him to love her more than Rachel. But he doesn't. But she doesn't give up. She keeps trying. We keep reading. She conceived again, and when she gave birth to a son, she says, because the Lord heard that I am not loved, he gave me this one too. So she named him Simeon, but still, she's not loved. And so again she conceived, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, now at last my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him three sons. So he was named Levi. Do you hear what is the deepest desire of her heart? More than anything, she wants to be loved. She wants Jacob, her husband, to love her, and she does not get what she longs for. She's married, she's having sons, and she's still unfulfilled. She's still incomplete. There is still a hole in her heart. Now, Jacob initially, he uses love to get sex. And Leah uses sex, having sons, to get love. And it doesn't work out for either one of them. When all the dust settles, they belong to this huge family that is characterized by jealousy and deception and heartache and heartbreak, betrayal, chaos. And of course, that's what happens when you look to a created thing for something that only God can give. What we have here in this story is a classic case of what Tim Keller calls in his book, Counterfeit Gods, cosmic disappointment. The quest for apocalyptic romance, life-changing love, leads to, inevitably, cosmic disappointment. 2016 was an election year. The New York Times had a lot to say about politics in the election in 2016. And yet the most popular article on the New York Times website was not about politics. It was an article by a philosopher entitled, Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person. Not why you might marry the wrong person, not why some people marry the wrong person, not how to keep from marrying the wrong person. It was a definitive declaration of truth. Here's why you will marry the wrong person every single time. And the article captures the essence of this idea of cosmic disappointment. Because no matter how certain you are that you found your soulmate, no matter how convinced you are that you're about to spend the rest of your life with the one who can make you forever happy, at some point you wake up to disappointment. Guys, we go to bed with Rachel, the woman of our dreams, and we wake up with Leah and her weak eyes. Metaphorically speaking. Ladies, metaphorically speaking, you go to bed with Romeo, the man of your dreams, and you wake up with Lenny and his video games. My apologies to anyone here named Leah or Lenny. It's a metaphor. Why cosmic disappointment? Because no human being can bear the burden of our hopes and dreams, our divine ideals and expectations. No created thing, no human being can fill the hole in our heart. It's impossible. We would like to believe otherwise. We watch movies and tell each other stories that would suggest otherwise, but it just doesn't work. If you Google the top most romantic movie lines of all time, you'll find several websites that list some of the same movie lines over and over and over again in different order. There's always a debate about the order. But here are some that you will find. See if you can tell me what movies these come from. As You Wish is from the Princess Bride. Very good. This next one is more than one line. It's a bit of dialogue between two characters. First person says, I love you. Second person says, I know. What's that from? Star Wars, which one? It starts with The Empire Strikes Back, but then it flips, and it's also in Return of the Jedi. Very well done. Now, here's another one. You know this one's coming. You complete me. Well, Jerry Maguire, spoken by Tom Cruise, who desperately needs to be completed, right? You complete me. It's a great line. And it is one of the biggest lies that's ever been spoken in a movie. If there were to be a sequel to Jerry Maguire, perhaps it would be titled Jerry Maguire. Turns out, no, you didn't. It's a great line. It fits within the movie. It's the kind of thing we might like to say when we're proposing or in a wedding ceremony or over candlelight on our honeymoon. But at some point, you wake up to cosmic disappointment and you realize he doesn't complete you and you can't complete him. She doesn't complete you and you can't complete her. If you are sitting next to your significant other, please turn to one another right now and say, you don't complete me. You say, trust me, this is good for your relationship. You both know it. Just say it out loud. You don't, now say, you can't complete me. And if you don't have a significant other, know that as you're sitting there thinking, if only. The truth is, there is not a human being walking on this planet right now who can complete you. And if that's what you're waiting for, if that's what you're longing for, you will always be disappointed. It is unfair to ask another human being to complete you because no created thing can fill the hole in your heart, including an incomplete human being with a hole in his or her heart that he or she is desperately trying to fill just like you are. It won't work. I want to read another quote from Ernest Becker, but before I read this, I want you to understand, he's not writing from a Christian perspective. He has no theological axe to grind. He's an anthropologist. He's observing the way humanity behaves when they give up on God. And this is what he says about apocalyptic romance. He says, the failure of romantic love as a solution to human problems is so much a part of humanity's frustration. No human relationship can bear the burden of godhood. However much we may idealize and idolize the love partner, he or she inevitably reflects earthly decay and imperfection. After all, what is it that we want when we elevate the love partner to this position? We want to be rid of our faults, our feeling of nothingness. We want to be justified, to know our existence has not been in vain. In other words, we want to fill the hole in our heart. We want redemption, nothing less. Needless to say, he says, human partners cannot give this. You can't complete me, and I can't complete you. And so our quest for apocalyptic romance, fueled by the soulmate myth, that there's a soulmate out there who can complete us, leads to cosmic disappointment. And Keller says, when we experience this cosmic disappointment, we can respond in four different ways. First, and probably the most common way, is we can blame the other person. We're disappointed, and it's his or her fault, and that leads to hypercritical correction, constantly trying to improve the other person, telling them what they can do to be better, to do better, so that they'll live up to our ideals, so that we can feel better. We try to make ourselves happy by fixing them, which only makes everyone miserable. Untold number of relationships have been sabotaged by hypercritical blame. We blame the other, which can make us critical, or we can also blame the other, which makes us think, well, we just need to leave and seek out a more perfect union. One marriage therapist observes that a lot of people get divorced, they have an affair and get divorced, not because they're unhappy, they just think they could be happier. There's someone else out there. So they trade in so they can trade up, finding someone who can fill their heart, only once again to realize they've married the wrong person. We can respond to this disappointment by blaming the other, or we can blame ourselves. We're the problem. We're unfixable. We're unlovable. We pile on the guilt and the shame, which makes everything worse. We can blame the other person. We can blame ourselves. We can also blame the world. We can blame the opposite sex. Get mad at the world. Become cynical and jaded. Love, what is love? Love is just an invention by corporate America to sell flowers. I don't believe in love. Bah humbug. Or, rather than blaming ourselves, blaming others, blaming the world, we can respond to this cosmic disappointment by reorienting our focus to something outside of creation. C.S. Lewis was big on this idea. Here's one of his most famous lines. He said, "If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world." If I can't find anything within creation to fill the hole in my heart, then perhaps I need to look beyond creation. Perhaps the hole in my heart is God-shaped. And only God can fill it. This seems to be what Leah realizes after she has her final son. If we go back to Genesis 29, it says, "Leah conceived again, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, 'This time I will praise the Lord,' period. And so she named him Judah. And then she stopped having children." Leah does not find fulfillment in Jacob. She does not even find fulfillment in her children. She finds her fulfillment in the Lord. Only God can fill the hole in her heart. "This time, I will praise the Lord." It's worth noting that Judah, her fourth son and his descendants, they play a pivotal role in the gospel story. Jesus is born as a descendant of the tribe of Judah, whose mother was unloved and unwanted, but finally found love, not in the arms of Jacob, but in the Lord. And her descendant, Jesus, did not have a hole in his heart. He was not needy. He was not incomplete. And yet, he took for himself a bride anyway, the church. And he demonstrated his love for his bride, the church, by laying down his life for those whose love could never match his. When Jesus married the church, he knew it was filled with all the wrong people. And he did it anyway. The soulmate myth would tell us that we must find someone to love us so we can be complete. The gospel sets us free from the illusion that any human being can ever complete us. Because in the gospel, we see the love of God put on display on the cross. And when we look at the cross, what we see, whether we are single or married or single again, when we look at the cross, what we see is that we have already been loved completely.